ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
The prosecution has put nearly 40 witnesses on the stand, and they will be done, almost done. The defense hasn't shown their hand yet in the trial of Corey Richens. Two mistrial motions already filed, a jury sitting on a mountain of circumstantial evidence with no video, no confession, and no one who actually watched it happen. This is where the case gets decided, not in the evidence, but in how all of it lands. Joining Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and myself, is Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, to get into the land of Corey Richens. And there's a lot to get into today. I'm just going to pick up where a lot of it left off as of our recording the night before. The private investigator on the stand and the defense going down a road. In this first segment, I want to focus on the defense and where they've been going, but they took us down a path that I certainly did not have on my bingo card for this case. Did anyone have that the defense of Corey Richens is going to try and insinuate that Eric was having an illicit affair with his male friend in this trial? I didn't think it was going to go there. I was like, what? And clearly, there was texts amongst friends, and they're screwing around, and they're saying stupid things to each other the way people do. Well, the defense of Corey Richens sees it very differently. Let's start there, Bob. Did you have this on your bingo card for the trial of Corey Richens?
I did not have it on my bingo card.
I didn't have Todd Gabler on my bingo card in terms of what he ended up being. Which I thought was an absolutely fascinating witness. He's interesting because he's typically a PI.
Yeah.
And Robin will tell you, I mean, typically government uses cops, you know, they don't typically use PI. So it's rare to see a PI being called by the state. Mm-hmm. In any case, usually it's us calling our PI who's gone out and done the investigation, which we have an ethical duty to do. Yeah, no, man, I did not see that coming. And we were talking about it after the fact. I don't think that there was so much even that the defense was kind of leaning into it, but I think that they wanted to put it out there to kind of support this proposition that they are putting out there, which is that Corey didn't know exactly everything that Eric was up to. Just not that it was necessarily even true. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? They just wanted to put it out there like, you know, Eric might have been popping pills and I didn't know about it. You know, maybe Eric was involved in some kind of relationship with his buddy Bryce that I didn't know about. So I thought that that was kind of the goal, because if you look back at when Bryce testified, that would have obviously, if they were really digging into that concept, mm-hmm. that would have been the time where they would have asked him on the stand. So I think they put it out there just for the purposes of again, just trying to to build this concept up in the jurors' minds that potentially Eric had some shit going on in his life that Corey was not privy to. That's the way I took it.
You know, Bob, that's an interesting observation. I didn't quite think of it that way before. You know, not anything that the defense is going to do to kind of go down that road and say, hey, he's got, you know, these illicit affairs with men as a big point, except like you said, to kind of prove the point that Corey didn't know anything. I'm curious, doing a thought experiment on this one, you know, say Corey is your client and you're on defense. I'm curious. She has had such a zero reaction in the courtroom to most things. Do you think it either helps or hinders or is not even involved at all when they put out there that Eric might have this secret life that she's not aware of and she doesn't have a really reaction to that? Does that help or hinder, do you think?
I always tell my clients, if you can, I want you to show zero emotion to anything. Don't like nothing. Because everything that a defendant does in a trial, especially if it's being televised or streamed, is going to be, and I always, like we always say, I always consider our chats to be the jury. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, those are citizens that are watching this thing. And you see it all the time when anybody makes any kind of facial movements in a trial or they're not doing something. Well, why aren't they crying at this point? Or why are they crying at this point? Or they're faking crying. I don't want to have any of that come into play if we can avoid it, because it's never helpful, because people are going to take what they will from whatever kind of facial contortions that the defendant is going to make. So if possible, I'm always telling my client, be as stone faced as possible. I want your poker face on the entire trial. I realize it's going to be hard to do.
If prosecution is painting her as this heartless individual and she's been told not to have a response, does that kind of feed into the confirmation bias of what the prosecution has been trying to paint her as?
Maybe.
Or is it still better to just not have an effect?
In my estimation, it's better to not have an effect because of the fact that I think that it'll be misconstrued. It's too easily. It's the same concept of why we don't put our defendants on the stand if we can avoid it. You know, because one thing that's misconstrued in terms of tone, tenor, or a word can sink your ship, you know, and it's the same thing. You saw it in the Karen Reed trial, you know, it's like everybody in trial one was like, Karen was making all kinds of faces, you know, and again, you have to look at what the general public is saying as kind of an ability to be able to glean what the jury might be thinking as well. And in that particular situation, it was not helpful to read. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you think it would have been a big leap for her to not react? Or do you think this is her natural state of being?
Who, Corey or Reed?
Reed couldn't help herself. You know, she just spills over all the time. But in Corey's case.
But it worked for Karen. I mean,
the second time it did.
The first time it did not. The second time.
On one of the counts in the first one. So it didn't work the first time.
True. But the second time it did. How do you think Corey's reactions are landing here? I mean, we're getting the look. I'm trying to figure out how to describe it. It kind of reminds me of like a mother watching her child's like play and you're like, okay, read the lines right. I hope you get that right, honey. You know, and then also just utter shock when someone, almost over the top shock, when someone is saying something aloud that you are going to act like how dare you say that? That's crazy. That's insane. I gotta say, her reactions look fairly genuine. I believe she's actually reacting in a genuine way. It's just, I don't know that reality and the cognitive distortions in Corey's mind line up with reality. is she genuinely having these? Yeah. But is it because she's genuinely shocked? Or what is the reasoning behind the faces that she's making in that corner? Room.
I thought that you described him perfectly, because there is that kind of like mother watching her child in terms of watching her attorneys perform. And, you know, you can see sometimes she's like, okay, you know, I need you to be saying something different, or I need you to be more on top of your shit. And then, you know, you get the raised eyebrow one, You know, where she gets, where if she was out and still getting her Botox, you wouldn't see the lines in her
forehead. Yes,
but here we, because she's been in jail waiting trial for all this time, we have the ability to be able to see her when she raises her eyebrows every time. And that's typically in response to somebody saying something on the stand. I mean, I think they're genuine, you know, but like, again, I'm always looking at it from both, both perspectives. I'm looking at it from, okay, is she guilty sitting in that room or is she innocent? And approaching it from that in terms of what I think she's doing, because it's like, I don't know how good of an actress Corey Richens is, because I don't know her from a hole in the ground. You know what I mean? All that we have to kind of gauge that on is the 911 call, which I think we talked about at length last week. And also the, you know, the body cam, the body worn cam footage where, you know, like I thought that her behavior was very bizarre. And that, which kind of tells me she's not a great actress, because, you know, her hiding her face the entire time was strange to me. Was she trying to hide the fact that she wasn't producing tears? Do her tear ducts work? I don't know the answer to any of these questions. So it's like, to me, it's always a dangerous path, you know, to kind of walk down. But I also am hyper aware that that's the kind of shit where the jury lives, man. It's like, those are the things that the jurors just pick up on and they run with it. You know, I've seen it over and over and over throughout my career. You know, it's like, I'm always begging the jury, please don't go to the emotional place. It has no place in the law. It has no place in this courtroom, but humans are going to human, you know, and people are going to feel things, and people can't put that aside a lot of times. And ultimately that ends up really being a big boon to the state typically.
You know, and you say we don't know her, because you're right, we don't spend every minute of the day with her like her family does and even with her attorney. But at the same time, though, they do present information and a pattern and points in her life arc that kind of give us an inclination. We don't know how good of an actress she is, but we do know she has a semblance of being able to really, really, really take advantage of men, as testament to her boyfriend that gets up there, looks like the saddest mope that just got taken advantage of by this woman who with no pay, no salary, maybe some gifts promised along the way, he relocates to Utah. So I think the data points that they lay out say that you might not know her, but we know enough about her to say it's potentially possible. And I get it, you data, evidence, and details, but human beings are emotional, no doubt.
There's no moving off that. You know, we try to, you know, sell that concept that you got to put your emotions to the side at trial, man. They just, it's really, really hard to do.
Who's steering the ship here? I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, Corey's the one that can make the calls, but how much do you think the attorneys for Corey are pushing back at her ideas and saying, maybe we shouldn't go down that road? Or are they just like, whatever you want, Corey? Because I mean, it feels a little unhinged at times where they're making a lot of spur of the moment decisions right there about admitting this or not admitting that. There was that the other day. What was it with someone that was at the walk the dog letter or something where they decided right there, like, Corey, how much should we add in? Just let it all go. Corey was pretty much, I mean, there seems to be I don't know if it's a level of unpreparedness or if it's just kind of how these things go when you're in the courtroom and things are moving at the way that they're moving. Bob can speak to that a hell of a lot more than I could. But how much do you think there's attorneys with experience that know how to captain this ship and they are taking this thing through the waters the best they can? Or you have it's invite a passenger to steer the ship day, which seems to be kind of like curious. What's your thoughts?
No, I don't think it's, you know, Nestor and Lewis and, you know, I see you in our friend Jay's chat. Jay doesn't know anything about the law. Like he's a strict emotion guy. He's just saying, I hate Corey. These women are morons. They're not. They're both very, very talented attorneys. This is a tough case.
Yeah.
It's a very, very difficult case. And people that have never tried a case that, you know, are sitting and calling lawyers morons that are working their ass off trying to get through a 5-week trial that has a massive amount of messages. I mean, there's just a lot of evidence here, like thousands of pieces of evidence in this case. And, you know, what you're seeing is a result of some of the pretrial motions wherein the judge deferred to make decisions on things. Mm-hmm. So wherein, you know, they're trying to keep certain statements suppressed or out. And then you've got the judge saying, all right, well, I've got to see what ends up kind of happening organically through the flow of the trial. And we'll take it as it comes, which is what you're seeing. Like okay. This morning, they spend an hour going through some emails, and they're now going through the jail calls, which in theory you would have liked to have seen done prior to, because you got a jury sitting back in the room waiting to come out, you know, and it's been going on for an hour now. But I mean, they're important facts in terms of what's going to come in, what's going to be redacted, and how it's going to be presented to the jury. So they're all important things. I don't think Corey's running shit.
Okay. I mean,
both Nestor and Lewis, they're both federal defenders.
Yeah.
You know, and Robin will tell you, you know, I mean, when you're talking about the federal criminal system, just federal courts in general, you're talking about the brightest judges, the brightest AUSAs, and the brightest attorneys on the defense side in the country, typically. Like if you were to look at the pedigree of these folks that try federal cases, they're of the highest caliber, typically. And, you know, it's like we also know that Nestor is representing the Robinson guy who, you know, with the guy
Charlie Kirk.
So she, you know, she's got a fucking lot on her plate. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Sure.
That case isn't on pause in every.
No,
other.
No.
So she's, you know, and she's lead counsel in this thing. So she's got Lewis helping her, and you got Ramos down there at the end, who's younger. I think he's 8 years in, but both Lewis and Nestor are both, you know, 20 plus years federal defenders. They know what they're doing. You know, they really do. And, you know, and it's a tough case. There's a lot of bad facts, and they have to preserve a record. Mm-hmm. So defense attorneys don't give a shit what we're saying out here.
No, no.
Oh, well, she looks like she's confused. All right. Like, no, dude. It's like, I mean, I look at it differently because I've been doing it for a couple of decades. You know what I mean? I can see how it might appear to the general public. And again, what I think doesn't fucking matter at all, because it's the 12 people in that box. And if the 12 people in that box are feeling the way that the general public is, like that Nestor looks like she's unorganized, or that she's getting lost in, you know, in the weeds occasionally, then that's the way they're going to feel about it, which is not helpful to Corey at all. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, in terms of strategic decisions, I'm positive that the attorneys are the ones making any kind of, because Corey doesn't understand the rules of evidence.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? She may have a concept of how she would like to proceed in this case in terms of, because we know from the walk the dog letter, like that's what she thinks her defense should be. And so, you know, whether or not the defense is going to fully adopt that, we have to wait and see until they put their case in chief on.
You know, Bob, I'm so curious about this because I'm always so attracted to the human element of things, as you know. And
me too.
But I've never had the privilege of really working alongside of defense attorneys, you know, like yourself. I'm curious, you know, say you're Corey's attorney. Do you wind up playing like multiple double duties here because you're not only defending her, do you wind up being a counselor for her? I mean, how do you keep a client like that going every day and showing up and presenting what she needs to present to do the best she can for herself as well? I mean, are you a confidant? I mean, is there someone else on the team? You know, cause that's, I know it's kind of getting in the weeds, but I'm really curious about that. Cause you gotta be everything to this person.
100%. And you are. I mean, you're your lifeline. And we were talking about that like last week a bit in terms of like the difference between prosecutors and defense attorneys in terms of our relationships.
It really hit me when you said that.
Yeah. But like with the family as well, you know, I mean, and it depends, Robin. It's a client by client thing because everybody's different. Now, Corey is very engaged in her own defense. You can see it. She's constantly taking notes. She's very involved with it. You know, I've had defendants that just sit there like a bump on a log, you know, that are like occasionally in my ear when I'm trying to listen to a direct examination. And I'm like, hey, man, I gave you that pad of paper to write your questions on. I need to listen to this because I'm cross-examining this person in like 25 minutes. So, I mean, in terms of kind of keep her. And I think that Corey believes that she's got a strong case. You know, and whether that's born out of the fact that she actually didn't dose her husband with fentanyl and kill him, or whether it's because she just thinks that they don't have a strong enough case to prove it, I don't know. at this point. I'm going to wait until everything comes out in the wash, and then I'm going to reach a conclusion. But yeah, to your point, Robin, I mean, yes, you are wearing many, many hats as a defense attorney. Obviously, the strategy side of it, you know, you're going to talk to your client about it, but ultimately that particular decision is left to the attorneys, whereas that incredibly important decision on whether or not the defendant is going to testify is left with the defendant. Now, I can, of course, advise them, you know, and say, look, it is a landmine filled field that you're talking about walking through if you take the stand, because there are a lot of questions that are going to be very difficult to answer and can be easily misconstrued if you say one thing the wrong way, which is going to get you found guilty. You know, so you're wearing that hat, but in terms of trying to keep your client up and, you know, kind of plowing through, I mean, yeah, you're paying, you know, that psychology hat is worn as well. It's it all comes into play. That's why I was saying, man, it's such a different job than the prosecutor's job, because they don't have that connection in with the defendant. You know, they're looking at somebody that is presented to them from evidence that is all on paper or on video or audio, you know, and they're trying to put together pieces to have it fit their narrative, whatever their theory of the case is, as to what they went, you know, what went on that night or that day. And it's just a different experience for defense attorneys, yeah, because we have the ability to be able to talk to our clients, right? Like you have that access to the person that the state does not, you know, but that's challenging as well. You know, it's like my job, frankly, doesn't require me to do what you see on TV, which is like, you have to tell me the truth. You have to tell me, depending on what kind of defense I'm going to employ.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If I'm employing an insanity defense, if it's available to me, then I need to know everything, because that's what I'm fighting. I'm trying to show, okay, look, this is the defense we're employing. It essentially means by operation of law that you've admitted to committing the crimes. We're trying to say that you're not legally responsible. You know, so I need all the details in that situation. If it's a situation wherein it's highly just or wholly circumstantial, in that particular situation, I'm never asking my client, did you do it or didn't you do it? Because it doesn't matter to me in terms of what the job is. The job is to ensure that my client's getting a fair trial, and to ensure that they understand their rights, to ensure that the cops and the prosecutor did their job correctly. And if I get all those things accomplished, the facts as they come out are typically going to win the day. You know, if they have the evidence, 90, 95 or higher percent of the time, they're going to get convicted. You know, most of the times they get it right, you know, and it's those cases where maybe they didn't get it right. Maybe there was tunnel vision. Those are the ones that you're worried about as a defense attorney, where you're really making sure your job's always the same. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter. So, and plus, you know, that question I always get, probably the first question, if you're representing that somebody who's been accused of doing some really, really horrible shit, is how do you do that? How do you put your morals to the side and like plunge forward with that? And I just answered the question. Right. You know, it's like I'm not focusing on that. I'm focusing on the things that are my job. Mm-hmm. And frankly, everybody in that courtroom, prosecutor, judge, defense, families of the victim, they all need it done right the first time, because nobody wants to go through that thing again, especially the victim's families.
And how do you keep yourself going? I mean, that's a lot. It's a lot. I didn't really appreciate the burden of a defense attorney until really working and listening to you for so long.
Yeah.
And so how do you keep yourself going with that kind of energy level? Because we talked about how you kept Corey going, but how would you keep yourself going playing so many hats to so many people during lengthy trials like this?
And just gut punches, man. You know, I mean, when you're going up against the power and the resources of the government, and, you know, you're consistently taking gut punches, you know, because it's just the state has the advantage just in terms of those resources. I mean, things as simple as, you know, the prosecutor's office is typically in the courthouse. Now, that may not seem like a big deal, but in terms of prepping for a trial and the state having the ability to be able to roll all of their things out from their office into that courtroom. Like for us, you know, I'm having to go ask the state if we're in a courtroom that's not completely teched out, like some are, right? In terms of screens, the access to be able to show videos, the access to be able to make things easier in terms of the mechanics of trying a case, which is a huge amount of work. It's a huge amount of work. That's why you see, you know, there's so much evidence to go through and you're trying to plow through and you've got different witnesses that you have control of in terms of that you're going to be either crossing or directing when it's your case in chief. And those people are your responsibility. You're trying to prep your questions. You're trying to keep track of all the evidence that's coming in. So it's like little things like having kind of a home field advantage as the prosecutors, just being in-house in terms of being in the courthouse, as opposed to us dragging everything, not being able to bring our tech, not being able to get everything real fluid like we'd like to be able to do it, is like just a small microscopic example of the advantages that the state has. And, you know, for me, Robin, I mean, it's I got burnt. You know, I was 23 years in, and that was really the impetus of me saying, I went to my wife, and when I started the Buried podcast, you know, and I had these tapes from my father and I'd held on to them. I went to her, I said, look, babe, like I'm getting to the point where I'm burnt out. Like, and that is doing a huge disservice to my clients. So, you know, I feel like I need to take a step back, you know? So I essentially retired from it because it was for all those things, man. It just grinds on you and it is hard. And you just feel the weight of the world on your shoulders because, you know, if you have a client that you in your heart of hearts believe is innocent and they go down, I mean, that is a tough burden to live with every single day of your life. And it's not like, you know, I always say to me, being a defense attorney is probably the toughest job on the planet because somebody's liberty and or life literally rests on your shoulders. And it's different than, say, a surgeon who can save somebody's life. But, you know, if things take the course that they're going to take and that surgeon can't save that person for various reasons, I don't think that surgeon is carrying that on for years. You know what I mean? Whereas for me, if I have a client who I felt I didn't do the job for and they got convicted, that's sticking with me forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or if I have a client that's getting the death penalty and they're going to execute them, where, you know, ultimately I felt like my job was just to preserve that person's life more than innocence or you know, guilt. Like that just, it weighs on you. You never, like my dad defended Gacy, who's like easily one of the top five monsters to ever walk the planet, or at least in this country. Guy was an absolute nightmare, but my dad still felt responsibility for Gacy getting executed because my father truly believed that Gacy was insane, you know, and that because of that, he should have been in a mental institution for the rest of his life as opposed to the eye for an eye being executed. But try convincing 12 people that somebody who killed 33 people should live. You know, it's a tall task.
It all comes down to everybody is human. The defense attorneys, the prosecutors, the defendants, the jury. You have the human element in every single aspect of all of this. Even when people are acting inhuman, the rest of them still are. That's the thing to remember. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube on this segment. We'd love to see them and hear your thoughts.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.